Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Frank M. Robinson, whose latest novel is The Donor. Previous novels include Waiting, The Dark Beyond the Stars, several novels written in tandem with other authors, History of Science Fiction, Illustrated History of Science Fiction, as well as books about pulp magazines, collecting, etc. Frank M. Robinson is a longtime San Francisco resident and was Harvey Milk's speechwriter back in the days of the 1970s. Frank Robinson, I've known you for a long, long time, and the one thing I've known about you, which a lot of people don't know, is that you're maybe one of the greatest teachers of how to write a thriller that I've ever run across. Using The Donor as an example, we're going to pick it apart a little bit, and we're going to talk about the nature of writing thrillers. People know what's good, but they don't know why.
You're flattering as hell. I really don't know that much about thrillers. I know a lot about the thrillers that I write. Greatest thriller writer going is probably J.K. Rowling, Harry Potter. Those are thrillers, pure and simple. But, yeah, ask me.
First of all, in terms of this kind of writing, when I'm calling it a thriller, what exactly am I meaning? What do you mean? How do you define a thriller?
A thriller is literally a book that you can't put down, a book that compels you to read it until you get to the ending. It's not one of these things that you read chapter by chapter. The first thing you do as a writer, the first thing you do is pick on a theme, develop your protagonist, put your protagonist in some kind of danger, and have a happy ending at the end of it.
So books that might not seem to be thrillers, even perhaps classics, in that sense, could be perceived as thrillers.
Oh, sure. Thrillers are one of the most popular types of fiction currently being published. If you look at the New York Times book review, the best-selling books, usually over half are mysteries and thrillers. There seems to be no end of desire for a good thriller. Call it a beach read, call it what you want, but it's better than TV.
And this goes back. I mean, a lot of people in the 17th, 18th century wrote thrillers, or did it really just start in the 20th?
I'm pretty sure it started in the 20th. My God, if you go back to the 18th and 19th, you go back to the days of the British novels about the British upper classes, that sort of thing. Even Dickens, although I suppose Oliver Twist could be considered a thriller. A lot of Shakespeare's plays are thrillers in one sense of the word. You don't walk out in the middle, that's for sure.
And Conrad could be said to have written thrillers.
Yeah.
All right, but in the 20th century, the thriller became more refined.
In one sense, it became more formulaic. You mentioned Conrad. I mean, those are literary thrillers. Thrillers today are not considered literature as such. They're a genre like science fiction or mysteries.
When you're talking thriller, though, what is the relationship of, say, the thriller novel as it emerged in publishing to, say, the pulps, pulp magazines of the early part of the 20th century?
Pulp magazines were the archetypical thriller. I gave you a brief summary at the beginning. You get a theme, you get a protagonist, you get them into trouble, and there's a happy ending sooner or later. And I would say 90% of the pulp stories ever written follow that exactly. Pick up Arrested in the first paragraph. We'll give you the protagonist, the situation, and get them into trouble right off the bat. Nowadays, it usually takes more than the first paragraph, although if I can do it in the first paragraph, I will.
That brings up, Frank M. Robinson, that brings up the idea of the hook.
The narrative hook.
What's a narrative hook?
Well, got it. The narrative hooks developed in the old pulp magazines, and they figured readers would pick up the magazine and maybe read the first paragraph or two. So the narrative hook was something buried in the first paragraph to hook the readers, so you would keep them reading, and they'd buy the magazine to find out what was going to happen. I'm very fond of narrative hooks, and I usually start them in the first paragraph.
Okay, let's look at your new book, The Donor. Okay, the first paragraph of The Donor. I'm opening the book here. The first paragraph of The Donor. Even with the drugs, Dennis Heller still hurt like hell. He shifted in bed, winced at the pain, then fumbled for the call button. Okay, it's basically about him, why he's in the hospital again. That's not the story. We don't know why he's in, but the hook gets you reading to find out why he's in.
Correct.
What would you call the reason why he's in, which is the motivation for the whole plot?
I would call that the engine. It's the engine that drives the story. The hook gets you into it, but it's the engine that keeps the story going.
The engine of this is that Heller wakes up and discovers that various body organs are being removed, and he needs to figure out why, which is the thriller end of the book. How did you come across that idea?
I would almost give it away, but ideas like that are both topical. They're extrapolations of what you read in the newspaper. They're news. I mean, the fact that various people have been harvested, meaning their organs taken against their will, that's an ongoing news story. They find a bum in an alley someplace and he's missing his kidney or his liver, and usually he's dead as a doornail. In this case, Dennis Heller, eventually within the first chapter, he ends up over at San Francisco General. He's been in this little jerkwater hospital. He figures that the doctor is trying to kill him on the table. He runs away, collapses in the bushes, ends up at San Francisco General. And they notice that one, he's pulled his stitches from a prior operation, the one he just had, and he has scars on his stomach from an operation of perhaps 2 years ago. And the doctor tells him he's been harvested under false pretenses. 2 years ago, he was in Boston Municipal having a gallbladder operation, but it wasn't his gallbladder they took out. They took out a lobe of his liver. You can live without a lobe of your liver. The liver regenerates. In the little hospital in San Francisco, they went in and they got a kidney. And here's where the hook comes. One, Dennis remembers, without ever having seen him, he remembers the accent of the surgeon who operated on him. In both cases, same surgeon. To finish the hook, the doctor at Municipal tells him, A, this is a very accomplished surgeon. B, he cost a lot of money. C, it would take a lot of money to hire him, which means whoever hired him has figured out that Dennis is a match, probably the only one that this guy could find. Since it costs a lot of money, we assume that this man has a great deal of money. If he is using Dennis as an organ bank, coming around every 2 years to take what he needs, the most logical thing that he'll want next will be the heart and the lungs. And you can't live without those. We got our protagonist into a really deep bind because, A, he has to keep the rich old man from finding him again, and B, he sure as hell better find out who the rich old man is. The other thing, I mentioned that being harvested for organs is not new. It's been done. People will donate organs. They will donate a lobe of the liver. They will donate a kidney. They will even sell them, given the chance. But this is the first novel I know of that's told from the viewpoint of the kid who was harvested.
Okay, let's take what you just said now. Okay, Frank Robinson, sitting down, coming up with an idea, comes up with the idea of the donor, okay, comes up with the idea of the person being harvested. When you do that, do you suddenly sit there and think, okay, this is, now, what is he going to be looking for? How is he going to think? Where is he going to go? Are you working backwards and going, aha, he needs to know the name of the doctor, he needs to know this? What is the order that your mind is working in terms of creating that original hook or engine?
A lot of this thing comes automatically to the writer. It's sort of like knitting a sweater. It's knit one, purl two. In this case, a young kid, nerdy student at San Francisco State, has been harvested and has to remain undercover. He has to get lost so nobody can find him. Since his first operation occurred in Boston, he has to go back to Boston to find out who the hell did it. The foundation stone of a lot of mysteries and a lot of thrillers, where they come down to 60,000 words of "you chase me" and another 60,000 of "I chase you." That was told to me when I fought the power years ago. It's never failed me.
You know where he's going to go. He's got to go back, and then you begin to fill in some of the gaps.
Right.
Okay, now, there's a secondary story, and the two stories converge, about a wealthy kid in Boston dealing with his psychotic father. We know, reading a thriller, these stories have to eventually come together, and we might even pick out why they come together. Do you really care if someone figures out why the two stories come together? Does it matter to you?
As a matter of fact, in the case of the donor, you know, with the first chapter about Robert,
right,
the wealthy kid in Boston, you know what the story is.
You were assuming that the reader would immediately be able to make the connection.
Yeah.
So then it's a question of two stories, how the two stories are going to come together, that's going to keep people reading.
Correct. You complicate things along the way. I mean, there's a wealthy old man looking for Dennis at the start. Well, midway through the story, there is not only a wealthy old man, there's another guy, approximately Dennis's own age, who is looking for him. And there's still a third person, a friend of Dennis's, who's looking for him. And all of them mean Dennis harm.
There's a certain point where I guess the story kind of just takes over because you've set it in motion, so it's like a rolling down a hill.
That's the engine.
And then it becomes easy, or does it?
Yes and no. In a lot of novels, the plot is the crucial thing. In this case, it was not. The characters were the crucial thing. And it's like saying, as a writer, I busted my butt on the characters to make them both attractive and to make them real. I know next to nothing about young, nerdish kids. And if you're going to write about them, you sure as hell better know how do they talk. So I interviewed two graduates from Stanford, recent graduates, and asked them a lot of questions and listened to them as they talk about their experiences just in living. And that was invaluable. Some of the most difficult part of this was the medical research. What happens in an emergency room? I talked to a couple of doctors who were interning at San Francisco General.
When you're working on a book like this, you've got characters and you've got plot. How do you ensure that the two meld together so that the plot makes sense, given the characters, and that at the same time the characters never become puppets to the plot?
It sounds easy. It's fairly complicated. It takes a lot of experience to do. But the heart and soul of suspense is what happens when. And what happens is little bit by little bit by little bit. It's like putting beads on a string. And it's very important what happens when. You don't want something major to happen too soon. You lead up to it. You want to keep, and that, incidentally, is what keeps the reader reading. At the end of a chapter, you can do cliffhangers. You can forecast what's going to happen in the next chapter. You can leave a character in danger, doesn't know what he's going to do next. Well, the author knows, but the character and the reader doesn't. The heart of a good thriller is what happens when. You could read the Da Vinci Code. And the Da Vinci Code is a page-turner. And inherent in that, saying it's a page-turner, is a study in what happens when. Gosh, I don't like to knock anybody's writing, but this is a good follow-up here. If you're going to have a reader spend $25 on a book or $17 at Barnes & Noble, you better make sure there's a payoff, that the reader is rewarded for reading 300 pages of story and spending that much time with it. So you have to have preferably a surprise payoff and a satisfying one. That was the one thing that I faltered the Da Vinci Code on. I got to the end of the book and I thought, eh. Another time I was reading Grisham's The Firm, which is a terrific page turner, and it has a terrific engine to it, a terrific plot. And you get to the end of it and it kind of all disappears on you. It becomes unbelievable, and then it's like a souffle that gradually falls. You understand, as far as the author goes, it doesn't matter, because to get to the ending, you bought the book. That was the big hook.
So let's talk for a second there, Frank Robinson. Let's talk about the two kinds of payoffs at the end. Okay, one is the surprise payoff. That's the ending, the moment where it all comes together.
Yeah.
Okay, now after that, there's the satisfaction for the reader. What is that?
The satisfaction of the reader is the conclusion of the major plot. Dennis ends up getting out of danger without giving away the whys and wherefores. There's a chapter that follows that, and there's a chapter that logically should follow that. And then you find out that perhaps Dennis wasn't the main character after all, which is what I love to do. Sorry. A good example of that, and this is giving nothing away since it's an old book, and that was The Dark Beyond the Stars, where you have a mutiny on board the spaceship and they all decide to go home because they haven't found life in the universe. And the last chapter, which I've been accused of tacking on, but which I really didn't think of until I got to the middle of the book, is they get home and the waiting for them are the aliens. They got there first. And that's the ending.
You're listening to an interview with Frank M. Robinson, whose latest novel is The Donor. What about the idea of there being three acts? Do you pay attention to that?
Yes. You can break a book up into sections, and then you break each section into chapter into scenes. The one thing you should not do is break your book in two, break it into halves. You break it into thirds. Very roughly speaking, the opening, the middle, and the end. It's kind of obvious. The most difficult act to write, of course, is the middle. What are you going to fill it up with? If you got any brains at all, you don't start the book without knowing what the ending is. It's like going from here to Boston. There's, you know, lots of different ways of getting there, but you better be sure you're going to Boston. The opening of the book is the same thing. You know what's going to happen in the opening, but what's going to happen in the middle? And that's where the one step at a time, what happens when, comes in very handy, because you come to the end of a chapter and then you think, you know, what I'm going to have in the next chapter. And there's an easy solution to that, and that is, what would your character do? Logically speaking, what's the next thing that he would do?
And that's where the idea of setting up a strong character comes in.
Of course. It helps to have a backstory. Although some authors make the mistake of incorporating the backstory into the main story and then the whole thing drags. But, you have to know your character.
Did you learn all this from working in the pulps when you were a kid?
Yeah, the first suspense stories, the first thrillers I ever did were for the pulps. First book I ever sold was one called The Power, made into a movie with George Hamilton, Suzanne Plachette, and a cast of dozens. That's strictly a pulp magazine story, and it's primarily plot. Although what happens when becomes very, very, very important. And it's also a case of so many chapters of You Chase Me winding up as so many chapters of I Chase You. That one eventually appeared in a pulp magazine. It was serialized in a pulp magazine called Blue Book. Yeah, I owe a lot to the pulps. I owe a lot to pulp authors. Old-time pulp writer and novelist Bob Tucker taught me a great deal. So did Paul Anderson, rest his soul. He was the guy who taught me, break your book up into scenes, which is essentially what a screenwriter does. And that's why, that's one reason why so many suspense stories and thrillers are ideal for adaptation to screen, because the author of the book is doing the same thing a screenwriter does.
You once told me that if you want to create a strong book, imagine it in your mind as if you're seeing a movie and then make the same cuts the director will make.
Oh, the moviola of the mind. What you do is you can imagine the scene in your head, and then you sit down and you write it out as if you were watching the film. And there's the characters, there's the setting, you have to pay attention to the setting, you have to let the reader know where he is, and you have to know what they're doing, etc. The huge advantage of a prose writer, a novelist, over the screenwriter is that the novelist has the use of internal dialogue. You can tell the reader what your main character is thinking. The advantage the screenwriter has is that you're going to actually see the main character. the screenwriter is hobbled. If he's not using voiceover or something like that, you have to do by expression, by situation, what the main character has to be thinking, talking about the film.
And that's why it's sometimes very difficult to translate.
This is why the films love action stories. It's much easier to portray action than it is character. If you read The Power as a book, it's almost all action and dialogue. And the guy who did the original screenplay, he said he found it a snap, because for the dialogue, all he did was take the first line of every paragraph.
How difficult is it for you to try to write an original treatment for, or even a screenplay?
Oh, boy. If you're a novelist, if you're writing a book, you're alone in a room and you're doing it all by yourself, except for the people you interview, etc. You're the boss. If you're writing a screenplay, you have to please a whole bunch of people. You got to please more than the editor, more than the publisher, and more than the agent. You have to please the director. You have to please the actors. You have to please the producers. How easy it is depends on your relationship with the director. How does he want you to work? And if he fails to tell you, if you're me, you're given the screenplay, you go ahead and write it like you would a book. Then you say, well, here's a book. Tell me the changes you want. And the director is immediately pissed off because he didn't get his own two cents in. He didn't work with you, say, chapter by chapter. He didn't lean over your shoulder and say, well, I think the scene ought to be like this. Or we're going to cast Tom Cruise, and he hates this kind of thing. You'll have to do something else. In retrospect, I would not care to be a full-time screenwriter. In the first place, only 2% of assigned screenplays ever get made into movies. I have a good friend who's supported himself almost all of his life by being a screenwriter and never seen his work on the screen. But also the money end. Everybody thinks, you're a screenwriter, you're going to make gazillions of dollars. For any would-be's out there, I'd say if you write a really successful paperback, you're going to make gazillions of dollars with a lot less pain.
Frank M. Robinson, you were involved in San Francisco politics way back when, and you have a very strong political point of view. What role does politics play in your books? Should it play a role in a thriller? A lot of people say that you're always writing something political, even if you claim you're not.
Yeah. You mentioned in the introduction that I was a speechwriter for Harvey Milk. I was involved in somewhat in gay politics out in Chicago, and when I moved to San Francisco, I got involved in a good deal more. I started in gay politics because I thought, gosh, this is going to sound like a speech, because I thought oppression was really, really bad. I knew a lot of gays, including myself, and we were all great people. We were fine people. We were not the scum of the earth. And when I came out here and discovered Harvey, he was running for supervisor. He told me. He said, this is going to be a hoot. He didn't expect to get elected or anything like that. And after having gone on marches in Chicago, holding kiss-ins and, gosh, one of the major squares, walking down Michigan Boulevard past the offices for Playboy, and I remember I was bopping along thinking, I'm just a reporter. I don't have an investment here. And a young kid carrying a sign suddenly thrust it at me and said, here, you carry it for a while. And I did. And in one sense, I never stopped. Harvey's death pulled me out of local politics. I mean, it was a huge thing for me. I couldn't talk about it for 5 years without breaking into tears. But what I had access to was writing. And I wrote a long piece for Out in the Castro about politics in the Castro, etc. In my books, I made sure that there were major gay characters in each and every book. And that goes back to The Glass Inferno, where one of the secondary leads is a gay interior decorator in the building that goes up. He was dropped for the movie, of course. In The Dark Beyond the Stars, everybody is bawling everybody else, so to speak. It's an enclosed world on the spaceship. And probably the most serious thing that I had was when my hero in the book, Sparrow, is seduced by a guy who wanted to be a minor villain, except he turned out to be such a good character, you know, he lasted till the end. But he's seduced by this kid, and when the kid leaves, he says, "Hey, Sparrow, you were easy." And Sparrow comes apart. One, he thinks everybody's going to be talking about it on board ship. Two, he's lost a lot of face. Three, he really hates this guy now. And Sparrow goes back to his little compartment, and a good friend of his named Crow comes in and says, "What happened to you?" Sparrow says essentially what happened. And Crow says, "Thrush has slept with everybody on board ship." And Sparrow says, "Including you?" And Crow says, "Nobody turns anybody down the first time." He says, "Do you want me to leave?" Sparrow doesn't say anything. So Crow stays. This is all first person. Sparrow is saying he had done the same thing with two people in the same night, one of whom he ended up hating, and the other of whom he ended up loving.
And in this book, you have a major gay character as well.
You know, the hero, Dennis, is going to have somebody along with him. Otherwise, it turns into a first-person thing, and it's not that. So Dennis goes to work at a bookstore. There's this little kid, well, small in stature, about 27, a couple of years older than Dennis, handsome kid. Dennis says, "You know, how'd you ever get to Boston if you were in Manhattan?" And the kid says, "Well, you know, he lost his lover at 9/11. Then he looks at Dennis and he says, "You know, sometimes it's hard for you to stand up. And when you were tucking in your T-shirt one day, I noticed all the scars on your belly." He says, "You don't want to talk to me about it. That's okay, but don't deny it." Dennis wants to find out what happened at Boston. And Michael said, "Well, I can probably find out." Dennis says, "How?" And Michael says, "The gay mafia is every place. And he's a buddy over in Records, and they can track him down." It's not one of these things where the gay character has a lech for Dennis, but the association is different. They were both screwed over by life.
When you're doing that, you're also aware that the gay sidekick dies in most conventional fiction.
I will never have the gay sidekick die, ever, ever, ever. In The Donor, the gay sidekick happens to be just as smart, if not smarter, just as good-looking, if not better, and just as brave as the hero. Why not?
What of a book like The Great Divide, which you recently rewrote portions of and just came out in paper? When you're working with someone else, do you say to them, "Well, look, I'm going to have a gay character. That character is not going to be your stereotypical Hollywood gay character"?
No, there were no problems on that at all. There was a simulated gay murder. I told you there has to be a murder at the start of all of these things. One cop has the standard version of the cop, another faggot but the dusk type thing. And the inspector said, "You know, what's wrong with this guy? Where's he been for the last 30 years?
Now, wait a second. You just threw something out there. You said there has to be a murder. Why?
There doesn't have to be a murder. That's off the top of my head, but let's put it this way. It certainly helps.
Do you ever follow the old Chandler routine of things are sagging here, gotta have a dead body or a murder?
I never learned that from Chandler. I used to be an office boy for Amazing Stories way back when, desperately anxious to find out how do you write science fiction, how do you write period. And I used to talk to Ray Palmer, who was the editor back then. And one of the things Ray told me is anytime the action begins to slow, throw another body through the skylight. He said that cynically, but I think he also meant it. And you don't want to do exactly that. Well, Da Vinci Code opens up with a murder, for one example. They're always helpful. There's murders that happen in The Donor, although not up front. In the old-time pulps, of course, it happened in the first chapter and the first page. In modern-day books, it may not happen until page 40, 50, or 60. But it's going to happen.
Frank Robinson, as an expert on the pulps and as someone who reads a lot of thrillers and writes these, as we get further and further away from the pulps and from the mechanics of creating a fast-moving story, do you think people have lost that touch on some level?
Yeah. As a writer, particularly in genre, the writing of novels compared to the writing of pulps. There were some very good writers in the pulps, but in general, 90% more of it was crap. The tendency is to, you develop your skills as a writer, and you end up writing better and better about less and less. That, I think, is what happened to a lot of modern science fiction, and in fact, a lot of mysteries, etc. The authors are writing better and better about less and less. Sometimes the author, particularly if he has a series character, he'll be carried away with his own omniscience, and he'll pay less attention to plot and character, especially character, since by the 20th novel in the Patrick O'Brien series, you know the character. In series novels, you get tired of the character, and you get tired of writing about him.
But people are forced to do it by economics.
You could take Ian Fleming. Did he ever write anything besides James Bond? I'm sure he did, but I don't know it. One exception to that is John D. MacDonald and Travis McGee. Did Doyle really ever write anything of importance outside of Holmes?
Frank Robinson, now that you've finished The Donor, have you begun working on something else?
I'm tossing around ideas in my head, sure. One of the books I like the best of all the books I've written was the science fiction book, The Dark Beyond the Stars. I loved the characters. I loved the idea. I had lots and lots of fun with the setting and all of that, and I wanted to do a sequel to it. In fact, when that book went out, I had a one page at the end of it summarizing the a projected sequel, and my agent threw it away, didn't want to negotiate two books for the price of one. But last time I was up to see my editor in New York, I mentioned the sequel. And this is just after the book they published, The Waiting. Waiting had turned out to be the most popular book paperback for them that they had published. My editor looked at me and he said coldly, that would be a bad career move. They didn't want to see science fiction. They want to see thrillers. I hate to walk away from the sequel to The Dark, and someday I'll do it regardless of money, and I don't care whether they buy it or not. I'll do it for my pleasure.
Do you have any plans to write nonfiction?
There was a book I got halfway through and then abandoned for a variety of reasons, all of them very good. The book was kind of like a, for lack of a better word, a sociological history of the gay community through the AIDS crisis. I think that nobody's really told that. Randy Schultz did a book based on Follow the Money, as Randy told me. But the early days of the plague in the gay community has never been covered the way it should be. We look now and we look back on it, and there's one figure that's absolutely staggering, and that is there's 20,000 guys who died from AIDS in a city of 700,000. If you cut off those over 60 and under 20, you know, leave half the women out, divide up straights from gays, that's more than seeing a community decimated, more than 1 out of 10. And the early days of it, there was no help from anywhere. There was no help from the feds, very little from the state. The community had to take care of itself with the help of the city. And the only reason the city helped primarily was because gays had electoral clout by that time. A lot of things I wondered about at the time, the promiscuity. You know, why did people put themselves at risk when they knew better? And there were answers to all of that, and some of that I never found until I got much further beyond. Almost all of the interviewees are dead now. I took around 40 interviews. The real early days of AIDS, going into the doctors and the patients and the people who wrote about them. I had friends who would go into the hospital one day, and 2 weeks later they were dead. They never got out.
So you're thinking of going back to this book then?
Yeah, I would have to. Somebody gave me $1 million, I'd do it tomorrow.
You've been listening to an interview with Frank M. Robinson, whose latest novel is The Donor, The Great Divide, written by Frank M. Robinson and John F. Levin, revised recently to update to current events, just out in paperback. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.